Welcome to another edition of Through Science to Health. Each month during the Friday noon hour, we bring you discussion, updates, perspectives, and insights surrounding the pandemic. This is your host, Chris Bricker, and in this special edition of Through Science to Health, we'll be revisiting two graduates of Port Townsend High School who have chosen the medical profession for their careers. We spoke with both of them back in November of 2020. Jesse Maupin began his work as a hospitalist at the University of Wisconsin Hospital during the thick of the COVID pandemic 2 years ago. He's now working at the University of Washington Hospital as a fellow in geriatric medicine. And starting this summer, he'll be working at UW Medical Center Northwest. Will Bringold is still a pulmonary and critical care medicine fellow at University Hospital in Madison. In addition to his clinical duties, he takes care of people in the ICU with both COVID and non-COVID related severe illness. He's in his final 5 months of training and will be starting a job at Tacoma General Hospital this summer. I wonder often about how both of you have navigated these past months, your personal and professional journey over the evolution of the pandemic, and your perspectives on the physical and psychological impact this has had on caregivers. Early on, Jesse, your letter to the leader about the need for empathy and compassion for caregivers and providers is even more relevant these days, especially for a community that has been pushed to its limits once again. What's this roller coaster journey been like for both of you from medical school until now? And Jesse, what was your motivation for writing that piece in your hometown newspaper?
So going back to the winter of 2020, when I first wrote that letter, I still think of that winter as the darkest days of the pandemic for myself and I think healthcare in general in this country. You know, it was before vaccines were widely available. We weren't sure what the next few weeks, let alone months, would hold and if the healthcare system would hold up. Luckily, it did barely. And I think we didn't see a catastrophic collapse. But, you know, that letter was really a reflection of the suffering and the pain that all of my colleagues and I were kind of experiencing and trying to convey to the general public what it was like to work within a frontline medical system. I think most people did not and still don't realize how close our public health infrastructure is sometimes to just being unable to provide the basic care that we all expect to be available at a hospital. And what I mean by that is both back in Madison and now currently I've been back in Seattle for about the last 6 months working at Harborview and the VA hospital here. These past few weeks have been almost as dark as the winter back in 2020. Harborview is designed to hold about 420 patients at any given time. For the past several weeks, we've consistently been closer to 500 patients every single day. What that means is that we have somewhere around 80 patients in the hospital who are in a bed that's in a hallway or separated just by a curtain from 20 other people. And we are at more of a staffing crisis than we have ever been at during this pandemic. So the level of care that we're providing to patients at these hospitals, which are top of the line level one trauma centers that we rely on, are not providing the care that we need to be. And I would not want to have any of my family members in one of these hospitals right now because there's a lack of high quality care that we can provide because we're physically unable to do that. That's kind of the background.
And Will, what's it been like for you?
For me, it's been, I guess specifically in the ICU, it's been the same from my perspective. I echo Jesse's comments on our abilities to care for patients. I mean, my ICU is 24 beds. And when those beds are full, we go out to like some of the other ICUs within the hospital, whether it's the burn units, whether it's the cardiothoracic units. And then when those are full, we can't accept patients. And we have lists and lists of patients who are just kind of waiting from small critical access hospitals that cannot come in. Sometimes it's not even for COVID. It's for other things that need to be treated seemingly, but cannot be because they can't come in. That seems to be the most frustrating aspect for me. It's the ones who need to be treated for other diseases that would usually have been able to easily been transferred in. Another thing I think is, like Jesse said, the people who directly care for patients are kind of stretched thin. Our nursing staff turnover here, like other places, I'm sure it's just been through the roof. And it's hard to keep good people, and people get burnt out, or they go somewhere else for better pay, or they just quit altogether. So that kind of adds to the difficulty.
What has the impact been for both of you in terms of, I want to say PTSD. I think that's a valid thing to say, considering the amount of hours that you've been putting in and some of the things that you've been seeing, especially in the volume of patients coming in there with COVID and the percentages of patients that are not vaccinated. What has that done for you both in your thinking and your desire to keep morale going, not only for yourselves, but also for your colleagues?
Yeah, Chris, I think burnout is an apt term. But I want to introduce another concept, which I think has really become much more relevant to me in the last year or so, which is the concept of moral injury. And that's a part of burnout. But specifically, what I mean by moral injury is it becomes impossible at a certain point not to take things personally when you are putting yourself out there for the benefit of the public. You know, we're going to treat anybody who comes in the doors to the hospital, no questions asked. But when you see time and time again, people not following common sense guidelines, not getting vaccinated when they're able to, and coming in and contributing to the overload of our medical system, it's really hard not to take that as a personal affront almost. And we want to have empathy for our patients. We want to have compassion, but it becomes increasingly difficult to empathize with these patients when we feel like we've been putting the desperate cry out there for help for nearly 2 years now, and people are either just, you know, going on with their lives or they're actively resisting those messages. And so, yeah, I feel injured on some level maybe this is PTSD that, you know, we'll be processing years down the line, but I've really felt my drive to do this work has diminished because I'm not sure how much longer I can put up with feeling like I'm just screaming into the void at a certain point.
Well, what's been your experience?
I don't know if I have any PTSD or feelings like that. I do agree with Jesse that sometimes trying to explain common sense falls on deaf ears. So I actually try not to do that because I think that alone would wear me out. It is frustrating when people come in and not vaccinated. They take up a hospital bed that could be used for someone who doesn't have COVID or something else. But I try to kind of look past that because people need to be treated with the same medical care as other people. You can't really judge them for their political beliefs. We didn't do that before. Can't do that now. It is difficult, though. I completely agree with Jesse that we are sometimes it takes away the empathy when the one ladder of the patient is a however so old, unvaccinated person. It just sets them in a different light than some other, say, 27-year-old who is fully vaccinated and boosted with a kidney transplant. And that's why he's in our ICU next to the other guy, which is a situation I have currently and I will have tomorrow when I go back to the ICU. But I think that in terms of personal and emotional balance with it, I think my group of fellows is a good group. My program director is a good group. I think that we stick together, use humor, sometimes dark humor, you know, but humor to get through the situation and do the best we can.
In your clinic work, you're treating not only COVID patients, you're treating other patients as well. And what's the balance looking like for prioritization and making appointments? And also, I'd like you both to talk a little bit about what telemedicine has done as a substitute sometimes, and whether or not that has developed into something that might be somewhat effective in some cases. I think there's no substitute for a physical examination, but maybe you could address that.
As far as telemedicine, I actually think that has helped some of our patients. I work a lot at the VA, and a lot of these patients live hours away. And oftentimes they couldn't get transportation, or it's too cold and there's snow on the ground and their VA bus is not running as unscheduled. And sometimes I agree, when you first meet someone, you need the physical exam to exactly figure out what they have, whether it be their COPD, whether it be some other weird interstitial lung disease. But the follow-up oftentimes in a patient can be done if you get certain tests along the way in the interim follow-up, and then you talk with them about their symptoms and how they have improved or not. it's not ideal. We always like to see people in the clinic, but I think that sometimes it can be helpful, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
Jesse, what are your thoughts about that? Do you deal much with that right now in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I do. So for these past 6 months, I have a weekly clinic, as well as I'm in a nursing home here in Seattle, 1 half-day per week. And that's really a new perspective for me, because for the last 3 years, I worked exclusively in the hospital. So now I'm seeing patients who are living at home or who are living in these long-term care facilities. And really the most striking, just undeniable aspect that I take away. And again, I work with adults over the age of 65, many of them over the age of 80, just because we deal with a complex population at Harborview. The social isolation is really just crushing people, especially in the nursing home. We have intermittent restrictions on visitors, so some people haven't seen family in months. And in clinic, many people haven't left their homes in weeks, or I may be the first person that's physically touched them in weeks as I examine them. And so that's a very important connection that we always try to get people in for in-person appointments. But for the past 3 weeks, we've tried to switch to video medicine as much as possible, which is great. It means that we can still check in. And most of my patients aren't dealing with COVID, because when you live to the age of 85, you generally are pretty savvy, and most of my patients are vaccinated, and they really need to talk about their non-COVID related, age-related conditions. So it's been a really invaluable tool.
Let's talk about prioritization. It's not like in the heavy, heavy onslaught of these waves of COVID. It's almost like triage. I mean, who do you treat first, and who's going to wait in the hallway? What's been the experience for both of you?
It's a little tricky because we usually don't say no to people who are in the hospital. I mean, if someone is on the floor and they get sick enough to come down, we treat that. What comes up more is triage from people coming in from outside hospitals, kind of that list that I talked about before, and the ability to bring them when the hospital that they're at does not have the ability to treat them, whether it's dialysis, whether it's basic ICU care, whether it's, an example, we have ECMO or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's just a technique to put more oxygen in someone's blood when their lungs can't do it. And it's very advanced in the ICU, but it's a very limited resource, kind of like how we talked about ventilators back in the early days. Luckily, we didn't have to limit our ventilators per se. We were able to get through and supply those who needed them with ventilators, but these ECMO machines, we do not. And they're being used more and more for patients who are very, very sick. So we have to say those who are the most likely to survive, the youngest, the most physically fit comparatively, those are the triage decisions we have to make. Otherwise, I mean, we try to get the people in who are need urgent surgeries, need things that we can fix kind of immediately, but it's sometimes impossible. I was at the VA and had to deny multiple people because we just didn't have any beds. And I had no way to even triage them because we just were not able to accept anyone. So sometimes you can triage if you can. Sometimes you don't even have the choice. You just can't.
Jesse, what's been your experience?
It's been interesting. As a fellow in geriatric training, I spend month-long clinical rotations in different areas. So my training is mostly focused on medicine for older adults, but we spend a lot of time in palliative care as well, which is sort of helping people manage the symptoms of chronic and serious disease. And the approach has been different, but with some similarities in those different worlds. So in palliative care, the heartbreaking thing is when family members are not allowed to come into the hospital or to the nursing home to see a loved one who's dying, just untold numbers of people have died alone these past couple of years. And so we try to triage and see the patients who need symptom management, who are in uncontrolled pain or have something that we can actually intervene upon. But there's very little wiggle room for triage when you're trying to protect other vulnerable patients, so you're not letting family members come in. This past month, I've been at Harborview on the orthopedic trauma co-management service. So I'm helping deal with patients who come in from all over the region with traumatic injuries. And our system has always been and remains pretty good at doing the very expensive high-tech interventions to stabilize people. So, you know, we have people come in with broken hips and we get the surgery done. But then the hard part comes where I had a woman earlier this month, upper 70s, who spent 2 weeks after her hip surgery trying to recover in the emergency room. What I mean by that is she was sleeping and trying to receive physical therapy, literally situated in our emergency room because there was no beds for her to go to upstairs. So we can stabilize people. We can do that surgery that they need, but then the rehabilitation is just not there. She just sat there not sleeping and becoming more and more frustrated for 2 weeks before eventually being able to go to a rehab facility. So the system, the way I see it, it's almost like we're unable to triage. We just have to be putting out the biggest fires first and then trying to do damage control on the back end.
For both of you, in the few minutes that we have left, as young physicians, what have you learned? I really appreciate your comment about moral injury, Jesse, and I'm understanding what you're saying about that. But for both of you, professionally and personally, as we climb out of this period, what does it look like for both of you, honestly, as providers and caregivers?
Well, you know, personally, in my personal life, it's affected my family fairly directly. My wife was a bedside nurse for 9 years until 6 months ago when she was done. She could not work at the bedside anymore. And this is dealing with systemic problems, I think, that predated this pandemic. Nurses have systemically and strategically been understaffed and under-resourced in hospitals for decades. She worked in a pediatric ICU, and they would consistently staff her ICU with the minimum number of nurses needed. It was frustrating to her, and she just eventually had to get out, and she's now in a similar career, but not directly providing care to sick kids. I've known many people who've given up working in medicine or have shifted to something less intense. And for me, I honestly haven't quite seen how that will work out for me, Chris. I really love my work. I want to continue to love my work, but I'm not sure how much longer I can continue to love working in the system with the type of interaction we have between the public and the healthcare system. There's a lot of problems there.
Will?
I think that coming out of this, and I do think that we will end up getting through it. When we talked last, I kind of hoped it would have been by this time, but I do think we will end up getting through it. And I think when we do, and when I do and look back, I think that all the experiences that I had, as bad as they were, will be helpful going forward. Because, I mean, you take these kind of hard times and you use them to say, oh, it's with the new situation, it's really not that bad compared to what it could be. And the things that we've done, whether it be through treatments, vaccinations, like all these things are happening so fast. And I think a big thing besides kind of taking the experience is that sometimes we do things to people in attempts to help and treat and do what we can, but we end up hurting them overall. There's been several examples throughout history of medicine that the treatments that we think help people end up hurting people. And I think that has been accelerated in the last 2 years of all these treatments for COVID and things that end up ultimately hurting people. I think to take a step back as a practitioner going forward and realize two things: that we can get through this with teamwork and good people, and that sometimes you can't just do something to do it. You have to be focused and you have to make sure that it actually helps, because sometimes it hurts. And that if you are someone that gives someone a treatment that hurts and you realize that going forward, that really kind of bites at your soul and can go kind of eat away at you as your career goes on. So I think those are the things that I will take forward from this.
Something I'd like to add is I think there was a huge missed opportunity during this pandemic for the public to really gain some insight into how medical science and research and therapeutics work. I feel like more and more we have to demonstrate to our patients that we actually know what we're talking about and are up on the science, because they've been listening to Joe Rogan or whatever. I really hope that kind of subsides and we get back to some normal interactions.
My heart goes out to you and all of your colleagues. Jesse Maupin, a fellow in geriatric medicine, the University of Washington Hospital. And starting this summer, he'll be working at University of Washington Medical Center Northwest. And Will Bringold, who will be finishing his final 5 months of training in pulmonary and critical care medicine as a fellow at the University of Wisconsin Hospital in Madison, and he'll be starting a job at Tacoma General Hospital this summer. Welcome home to both of you. And thank you so much for joining us here on Through Science to Health.
Thanks for having us, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks so much.